Welcome to Frameline. I'm Barbara Gosofsky, here as usual with my favorite critic, Courtney Small.
Hello, how are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I'm great. How are you?
Doing well.
Good. It's a double Happy New Year, just after the Lunar New Year. So I hope everybody's celebrations have been going well and are continuing. I mean, the Lunar New Year is a big deal. So anyway, Courtney and I have a lot to talk about today because, speaking of big deals, we have been virtually attending the Sundance Film Festival. Yes, it's in Utah. Yes, we are not in Utah, but we have snow. They have snow. It's cold. It's cold. What's the difference? Why go to Utah? I mean, it'd be nice to go to Utah and do it in person, but you know us, we can't afford it.
Yeah, and I mean, the festival has been very nice the last couple of years, like since the pandemic, of really trying to accommodate more accessibility and allowing both audiences at home and critics to partake in the festival virtually. And I have to say, the virtual system I find is quite flawless. I haven't had any issues at all. So bravo, yeah. Sundance, bravo.
Yeah, thank you, Sundance, and bravo, congratulations on another successful festival. So, needless to say, we have a lot of stuff to talk about. We've seen a lot of stuff a lot of good films that we really like, and Courtney's going to start us off.
Yes, one film that I saw at Sundance that I guess our listeners will be able to see in a theater near them at the end of this week is a film called Infinity Pool, and it's directed by Brandon Cronenberg, who is the son of legendary filmmaker David Cronenberg. And he has a new film that was playing in the Midnight category, which is similar to like the Midnight Madness at TIFF. So you get to see films that are a little out there that could be funny, scary, what have you. So this film really, I was surprised by how much I enjoyed this film. Infinity Pool stars Alexander Skarsgård and Mia Goth. And the film is about this writer by the name of James, who's on vacation with his wife. And he gets into an incident where he's driving and accidentally hits someone. And because it's a small country, they're very strict on the rules. But at the same time, they want to keep the tourism going. So they've come up with this form of punishment where for a certain amount of money, James can pay to have someone else take his place when it comes to the punishment. That is all I'm going to say about this film, because it's one that you kind of just have to see. It goes places. It's a interesting mix of like horror and science fiction, but at the heart of it, it's really a film about the wealthy. And I know we've had a lot of films in 2022 that were all about eat the rich, triangle of sadness, yeah, what have you. This film proposes that you may, say eat the rich, but maybe just the way how the wealthy are, they're always going to want to be the ones eating you. They will always want to have the ones that will use you for sport and whatnot. And it goes places. It's really interesting. I think the performances are great. And Mia Goth, who, she had a sensational 2022 because she was in Ty West's films X and also Pearl. And she is sensational in this one. Like there gets to a point where when she appears on screen, you just get a chill. Because you're like, oh, nothing good could come of this. So I highly recommend Infinity Pool. It's not going to be for everyone.
Is it kind of like weird, like his dad, where it's like it could gross you out?
It goes places. That's all I'm going to say. It goes places. So, take that a little bit of warning, but I really liked it. I think it's going to divide audiences, but I think it's the first Brandon Cronenberg film that I've truly, truly enjoyed.
Wow, that's fantastic.
I recommend that. You saw a film that I didn't get a chance to see that was a big hit at Cannes. Do you want to talk about Joyland?
Oh, Joyland. Oh my God, what a beautiful, haunting film. And I could see why it won the jury prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival. And I'm so glad that Sundance added, you know, a special, added it at the last, not at the last minute, but they sort of, it wasn't part of the original programming, and then they added it. And so audiences at Sundance, and I guess it's in anticipation of its wider release later, right? That we're just able, I'm going to be able to like spread the word early for people to watch out for this film. Joyland is this wonderful film about finding your identity, about realizing your dreams, realizing who you are. And it's done in this amazing, it's kind of like neorealism. So it's kind of like a dramatic version of verite, but it's done in the most creative way possible. Before I give you a description of what happens in the film, I'm just gonna tell you that everything in the film happens with practically within a single shot. It's incredible, like an entire scene can happen within one shot where the camera is still, and sometimes the camera is very close and sometimes the camera is further away. But so much happens just within that. And it's just the creativity of the director that's just astounding. And it's just such a quiet, beautiful film. And it never goes completely overboard. And it could. So I'll tell you what happens is it's about this man and Haider and his wife in India, and they're part of this extended family. It's complicated. Like, he lives with his father, who's like the grand patriarch, and his brother, who has like four children, and Haider and his wife had to have no children. And because Haider doesn't have a job, he's the one that has to help the sister-in-law with the kids. So he's ending up, his joke is that he's like a housewife, right? And he's ending up doing all this like housework because his wife has a job that she loves in this salon. But one day a friend of his comes and offers him a job, and it's a job as a backup dancer for this trans performer. And, you know, at first he's got quite the violent reaction against it. And then because it pays so much money, he decides he should just go along with it, but not really tell people exactly what he's doing. He sort of wants to tell them like the job is something else. And this sets in motion a whole series of events. So, and some of it is understandable. Like, you can see where it's coming from, and some of it is kind of surprising. But where the film ends up is this beautiful place of quiet grace. It's an astounding experience. And so, you know, it's really incredible. Joyland.
That sounds very good. I want to see that one, and now I'm even more enticed to check that one out.
Yes, and it, like, in terms of gender roles and, you know, sexuality and repressed sexuality, oh, I mean, it's just, this film says so much. Sorry.
No, that's good.
If you don't stop me, I'm going to keep talking about it.
No, it's good, because when you're talking about repressed sexuality, it made me think of another film that I watched called Magazine Dreams. And this is a film that stars Jonathan Majors. He was in Devotion, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, really talented actor. And it was directed by Elijah Bynum. And in the film, Jonathan Majors plays this bodybuilder by the name of Killian, who kind of lives an isolated life. He takes care of his grandpa, but he's very socially awkward, and he dreams of being on a magazine like his idol, who's this famous bodybuilder. But through the course of the film, basically Bynum is slowly showing the audience a lot of the, I guess, warning signs and triggers that leads to the incel culture that's kind of come about. You know, Killian believes that he is worthy of being on a magazine, worthy of being adored, but he's also desperate for connection. He wants something to happen so that he will be remembered for. And of course, when you focus specifically on being remembered, it leads you down a dark path. It's a very interesting film, but also it's one that's going to divide a lot of people, I think, because it's a dark, dark film. And because Bynum is touching on so many different strands, it's not as even as it could be. You know, there's a lot of points where he'll touch on a particular aspect, but doesn't really dive into it, you know, and the film kind of feels like it has multiple endings. Every time you think, oh, they're going to end here, it continues and goes on a different direction. So there's that to deal with. But I will say that what keeps it together is Jonathan Majors' performance. He is phenomenal in this film. The way, not just in terms of like his physicality, because he's obviously put on a lot of pounds for this role, but it's the quiet moments, the you can kind of see the brain trying to make sense of the world that he can't make sense of. It's a really fascinating performance, and I think for his performance alone, it's worth seeing, but just know that it deals with some heavy subject matter.
Yeah, he's an incredible actor. So yeah, mm-hmm. I think for that reason alone, this should be of interest when it comes out.
I know that it's a slightly different type of film, but there's one I know that we both saw that also has a lot to do with the human body. Did you want to talk about, is there anybody out there, I think it's called?
Yeah, is there anybody out there? It's Ella Glendinning, and it's a very, very, very personal film. It's about herself. It's about her and her body and her identity. She was born with a disability so rare that there are no reliable statistics for it. And she shows us, like, she interweaves this footage of herself as a child. And she is just this rambunctious, curious, beautiful child just going about, and she just wants to do everything. And we see that interwoven with footage of her now and in her strong, confident ways that she is. And she decides she's going to find people who, if they don't have the exact same condition, maybe similar. Like, she starts to show us her journey through social media channels of how she connects with people all over the world and starts to hear other people's stories. But meanwhile, we follow her personal story, and a lot of things happen in her life that she has to adjust, you know, her plans to. Something major happens and she has to like adjust her plans to that. But she proves herself very early on in the film. She proves to us that she's not the type of person to let anything stop her. So, you know, she does what she wants to do. And we know that, and we follow her and we celebrate her. And this is just one of the most beautiful personifications, one of the most beautiful messages of self-love that I have ever seen. It's just like she realizes this vision of self-love and presents it to us. And she doesn't do it to make us like feel like, oh, this is what you should learn from a disabled person. In fact, she's like showing like never mind the disabled part, I'm special. That's what she's saying. And that's really the most important part. And it's amazing and very, very insightful how much throughout the film she is constantly questioning ableism and what ableism does to people with any sort of disability, visible, invisible, you know, she just makes us question everything, which is for everyone who watches this film, another level of just understanding the world around us and other people, you know, how we relate to people. So this is just a very important film and an unforgettable experience.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. And, you know, to your point, how it calls out ableism is such a fascinating approach, because as you're watching it, you're sitting back going, yeah, I can't believe people are doing that. And then she'll say something and you stop and go, oh, wait, did I just do that? Like, you know, did I just think that way? And like, it could be like obvious things. Like if, you know, when she's introducing her, I guess at the time, boyfriend, father of the child, whatnot. And then she says, like, you know, about how people think that he's being charitable or something. And you're like, that's terrible. Okay. But then later on, she says something that you never thought of, right? Like, oh, how, you know, people move aside in when she's traveling down the road, but how they're always staring at her, right? And you think, oh, people are just being nice or what have you. But then when you really think about it and you start to put yourself in her perspective, you're like, actually, no, people, you are making her a sideshow when she doesn't need to be. You know, she's just a regular human. Like, there's a lot that, even if you think you are a conscious person, an ally, whatever terminology you want to use, this film will put you in your place, but in a way that makes you just be more conscious of the world. And like, and again, as you said, she's just a normal person, you know, but she's got this great drive. And I think one of the most fascinating aspects for me was when she was talking to a doctor who does, I guess you could say, corrective surgery or lengthening surgery on individuals who have similar conditions to hers, not quite the same. And that whole conversation and how, on one hand, what he's doing is very ableist, but then you hear about him, the reason why he got into this is because what they were doing to disabled individuals before, or individuals with disabilities before, was barbaric. But then at the same time, she's torn and is like, but these children aren't giving a chance. And again, you're still conforming to ableist views. Like, it's just a really fascinating, well done documentary that gives you a lot to think about. And you know, she's such a charming individual that you want to follow her journey. So yeah, I agree with you. It was a very good doc.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved it.
You know, I'm going to keep with the docs for a moment, and I'm going to talk about a film that kind of took me by surprise, and it's called King Cole. It's directed by Elaine McMillan Sheldon, and Sheldon was raised, I believe, in West Virginia, but this film kind of covers the central Appalachians, and it's really about the coal industry and how coal was king for a very long period in like West Virginia, Pennsylvania, all those places. But now, because of the world changing and evolving, coal is no longer the king it used to be. So what does that do to a, you know, town, community, chunk of land that was thriving off of coal? So throughout this doc, you get the history of coal, the importance of it in terms of how it, you know, the coal miners union was the first union, which led to like the auto union and then all these other unions after that. But you also see how people are very much indoctrinized in those areas. Like, there's a Miss Coal pageant, beauty pageant, you know, where the contestants are talking, all their speeches are about how, you know, they're supporting the miners and stuff like that. Like, there's a whole built-in industry, and even with coal declining, there's still ways of trying to make it seem like it's the most important thing, teaching it to kids in school, what have you. But then you also have this other side where Sheldon seems to be more of where she's like, we need to move away from it. But even her understanding, like, the economic benefits that it meant for like her family and those before her, how do you change that now where people still need jobs, but coal's not necessarily the way to go about it? And this film is shot in a way and told in a way where it almost goes into like the dreamscape, where coal is, you know, you're mixing Mother Nature and the beauty of Mother Nature with the destructive force of coal, and how easily it is to be swayed by the dark side. And it creates a very dreamlike atmosphere, which adds a whole other layer to this film. So it's not a film that just strictly preaches the evils of coal or the benefits. It just kind of tells you what life was like for her growing up, what life is like for that community now, and that weird in between where everything exists but no one knows quite how to quite deal with yet. So it's a really fascinating documentary that if you like environmental docs, or even if you just want a very interesting doc, I highly recommend King Cole. Since we're talking about docs, do you want to talk about Against the Tide?
Yes, it's actually quite fitting to talk about it, since you were just talking about a film that addressed the environment. Against the Tide addresses the environment in a different way and shows us some very dire situation in India with indigenous fishermen in India trying to continue with their traditional way of fishing, but because of climate change, they're having a very, very difficult time. And so it focuses on two men in a community, at the Koli community. And the Koli community is, you know, the indigenous community around Bombay. And so we're focused on Rakesh and Ganesh. And what I found interesting about the film was the way that the director, I think it's her first feature. She's got such control over this film. It's like, it's really taut. And like the verite style is really interesting, but she gets like verite, you say the word and people think, oh yeah, it's like, you know, not very interesting stylistically. It's like, no, she finds a way. Like she finds all these ways of playing around with the verite style. One of them is the way she constructs her shots, which is sometimes she's got like these really dynamic compositions within a shot. And then like in terms of like editing upon editing, so these shots are like edited together in this like really rhythmic way. And on the other hand, she has structured her film so that the through line of the film, like the spine of the film, is a series of conversations between Rakesh and Ganesh, because they're really close friends. And so as you know, as things go by, as events go by, they gather regularly together, just the two of them, share a meal and talk. The problem is that as the film progresses and things get more dire in terms of their situations, in terms of the fishing supply, the conversations get more tense, because one of them wants to investigate other ways and one of them doesn't. And the problem with investigating these other ways is it goes against tradition. And it's also environmentally not so friendly. So, but what the film shows us, like when I was saying that she creates these amazing rhythms and she really captures the rhythm of life of the community, but she also weaves in like culture, like all these things from the culture and cultural events and celebrations and this and that. So we get this, like, we get drawn into this community, and in terms of like their way of looking at the world and in terms of life, and we can see the tension and we can see like the dire situation that they're both facing, and their points of view. And just how tense and how like this is it felt like such a call to action to me. Mm-hmm. If you're going to watch a film about climate change, just watch this one, because this will make you want to do something. And I'm just so glad she made it.
Yeah,
I'm not glad about the situation, but like I'm just so glad that it's so effective. Like you can't forget it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that film as well. And I think one of the things that struck me outside of the whole climate issue was just the focus on ritual. There's a lot of ritual and the comparison between the two men, because one, I would say, is financially doing better off than the other. Like one kind of has the apartment or I'm assuming it's apartment or condo, and he's got like the kind of business where he's got like a whole crew of guys that can lift the nets and pull up the fish, where the other guy, Rakesh, is just himself on a boat. And, you know, Rakesh is dealing with, you know, an ailing child, whereas Ganesh is dealing with a child who's about to come into the world. Like, it's just really interesting dynamics between those. And I thought that was equally as fascinating as the plight of the industry that they're in. So, yeah, I agree. I highly recommend that film. I'm going to talk about a docuseries that's playing. It's called Murder in Bighorn, and it's a docuseries that's going to be coming on, I believe, Showtime in February, but it's premiering at Sundance. And it was the episodes were directed by Rizal Benali and Matthew Galkin. And it basically looks at the crisis that's occurring in Bighorn, Montana. And because of his position on the I-90 and because of history, you have a lot of people intermingling in Bighorn. But you also have two indigenous Native American reserves. And a lot of indigenous women are going missing in Bighorn, Montana. And it was getting to the point where it was almost becoming just a regular way of life until one particular young woman, a 16-year-old, disappeared, and it finally got like national media attention. And then the pressure was kind of on to figure out what happened to this girl. Why is it that every young woman that goes missing, or any woman that goes missing, when their bodies are found, it's always labeled like they died of hypothermia, even though reports. And so you get like the history of the relationship between the non-Indigenous and Indigenous within Bighorn, but it's also just, it really speaks to like the colonization in America as a whole, and how the legacy, like the creation of reservations, the creation of boarding schools, residential schools, has had a lasting impact on the Native American population, and just how much they keep crying for the world to take notice and Americans to take notice, especially when it comes to missing and murdered indigenous women, and how their silence keeps, you know, the cries for help keep getting ignored. So it's a really fascinating documentary series. I think the first part of it is a little more intriguing than the finale, just because they kind of set it up like the beat of a murder mystery. But once you really start to delve into the history, so if you realize that this is not a problem that can be solved and wrapped up in three episodes. So if you're looking for a straight, true crime style series, this is not it, even though it kind of has the cloak of one. But it's a really fascinating film that you'll learn a lot from. So I highly recommend it.
Sounds great.
And if you permit me, I will, just keeping on the theme of Indigenous-based documentaries, I'm going to just talk quickly about the film Bad Press, which is directed by Rebecca Lansbury Baker and Joe Peeler. And this is a film that I found quite intriguing because it looks at a media company, Muskogee Media, which is in Okmulgee, Oklahoma. Apologies if I've mispronounced it, but it's basically in the Muskogee Creek Nation. And that outlet gets their freedom of the press rights revoked. And what I didn't realize is that in America, they talk a lot about freedom of the press and it's in the Constitution. But when it comes to Indigenous nations, they actually have the freedom for their own laws. And the freedom of the press is not something that's guaranteed. So of like the 500 nations within America, only five of them have the right to freedom of the press. So you follow journalist Angela Ellis and her fellow workers at the Muskogee Media as they have their freedom essentially revoked, which means that the nation's high council can basically run what type of things are in the paper, which conveniently curbs any reporting of any scandals that they might be involved in. And it really delves into the important role of the press, but also without the press, how quickly corruption is allowed to flourish, and how, especially in this day and age, fake news and misinformation can just, you know, explode without it. So if you're interested in journalism in any form, I quite enjoyed Bad Press.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating issue. And it's a really important, as you said, because you don't really realize that freedom of the press has to be written into a constitution. And if an indigenous nation has their own control over, you know, their people and themselves, and they write their own constitution, they have to write it in there. Otherwise, it's not guaranteed.
Yep.
And so the fact, like you said, there's 500 plus, you know, across North America, and then you realize, but it's a microcosm of what's happening in the greater world, of what's happening in certain places in the greater world. Mm-hmm. And the way that they focus on these individuals, particularly the one woman, and it really comes down to us following her and bonding with her in a way, you know, as she's fighting, because it's a tiny community. And if she loses this fight, then she's getting the hate speech. She's getting like the threats against her. Like the people they know her. They like people who are against her. Like they know who she is. They know where she lives. And so that conflict, that tension, like it's right there. The film focuses on that really brings it to light.
Mm-hmm.
A vivid way.
And the last thing I'll say is you use the word microcosm, and I think that's a perfect word for this, because there's a point where in the film where an election or a series of elections is very important. And even with what happens with that, and then the possible talk of a corrupted election and, you know, who can validate and stuff, like you realize that even though, yes, it's happening in, you know, a particular area, these are things that we are seeing every day. The only difference is, like, especially in America at large, they still have the freedom of press, even if it's not as strong as it used to be. Whereas here, you see what happens when that's taken away, and it's a very scary thing.
Yeah.
Did you want to talk about, we'll change gears a bit, but do you want to talk about, was it Smokes on a Sisterhood? Is that the name of it?
Yeah, Smokes on a Sisterhood. Just the word sisterhood, I feel like, at this year's Sundance, I've seen so many amazing films already from female filmmakers. You know, it's just like brava to every one of you. And this one is an Estonian filmmaker named Anna Hintz. And Smokes on a Sisterhood, she focuses on this like ancient, talk about ritual. We were talking about ritual, right, with Against the Tide. Ancient ritual-based community, like in southern Estonia. This is, smoke saunas are a big deal in southern Estonia especially. And what happens is it's basically like a cabin in the woods, except it's a sauna. And this is where the filmmaker, I think it was filmed over 7 years, and she followed the same group of women as they went in, and she had this incredible access as she just filmed their experiences, because it's a very, the way she filmed it, like obviously it's a cramped space, but she turned it into this like intimate personal space. And eventually it became a safe space, and you hear the women talking, and you see them, and she does this really creative thing with the way she shoots their bodies. It's like this very stark imagery, but it's very beautiful. In a way that it highlights the beauty of the body, the female body, as these women go from like, discussions of everything from the female body, like how they're perceived in the world, how they're treated in the world, discussions around beauty and concepts of beauty and their experiences, all the way to like the power of the female body to give birth, all the way to the lack of power when they're being assaulted, you know. And so these women share these like very, very personal experiences. And eventually what's happening is that we, in terms of rhythms, she creates these incredible rhythms within and without, because sometimes they come outside into the lush green and they chant and they sing, and they chant inside. It's very ritual based. But they also sing, and then they cavort outside. So it's just like this sort of like buildup of emotions and then a release of emotions, you know, within the space and without. And then it's just this incredible journey into the depths of the female psyche. And it just shows us how that this release and how the body and women, the whole experience of being female, it can be a place of power. Like we see them move beyond the pain into a place of power. It's kind of messed up the way I said it, but trust me.
No, it sounds very
an incredible experience. Absolutely incredible.
It sounds very interesting. You know, excuse me for the horrible segue, but you did mention sisterhood. And it reminded me of a film that I did want to talk about, and that is Polite Society. This is a film that was directed by Nadia Manzoor. I believe it's her feature debut. And it stars Priya Cancera, who I believe is a star in the making, if she's not one already. This is a film that is an action comedy, and it is about two sisters. So Cancera plays Rhea, who is a teenager, and her whole goal in life is to become a female stunt woman. And her sister, her older sister, Lena, is an artist, but she's recently dropped out of art school and she's not quite sure what she wants to do with her life, even though she's very passionate about art. Their bond is wonderful. They're loving sisters, but then a man kind of comes in between them. This guy by the name of Salim, he's part of this very wealthy family whose matriarch is a little mysterious, might be a little evil. Anyway, Lena and Salim get very close, and within a short period of time, even though they haven't been dating that long, they're talking marriage, they're talking moving to Singapore. Rhea doesn't like this. She feels that something's afoot, and she constructs this plan to basically stop the wedding and save her sister. That's the premise of it.
I'm gonna leave it there and just say throw in a
lot of comedy, a lot of kind of Hong Kong style wire fu martial arts. You know, woo-hoo! there's a running gag involving the Matrix, and then there's times in the film where they're doing moves that, as if they were in the Matrix, and you don't question why they're able to leap the way they are. You just sit back and enjoy it. It's just a fun movie. I wish the script was a little tighter. I feel like some of the secondary characters are underutilized and feel a little one note, but the bond between the two lead sisters is wonderful. Like I just enjoyed them interacting on screen, and the fight scenes are fun. Like it's just a fun movie. And I know it was playing in the midnight section, and I believe this film will be getting major distribution. I want to say Focus has the rights to it. Apologies if I'm wrong about that, but I do know it will be getting a major release. So look out for Polite Society, especially if you're in the movie for just a fun time. So I highly recommend that. And female filmmaker. So it's also great to see female filmmakers doing more action, because we got a lot of that in 2022, and now we're getting even more this year. So that's great. So speaking of fun films, I haven't had a chance to see it, but I've heard some solid things about the Little Richard film. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. Okay. Talk about a character, Little Richard. I am everything. I mean, what's her perfect timing? And talk about women. This is directed by Lisa Cortez. So all credit to the director here. I think this one is also going to be available pretty soon, or eventually, like widely, like I think it's a CNN film. So there you go. But anyway, Little Richard, for people who don't know, is an early pioneer of rock and roll music. And in fact, with all this talk about Elvis, because the Elvis movie came out and all this talk about, there's always been this talk about he was the king of rock and roll. And in fact, he wasn't. The real truth is that rock and roll was created by any number of Black musicians, from Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who is mentioned in this film, Sister Rosetta Tharpe to Chuck Berry to Little Richard. So I feel like it's time to give credit where credit is due. And this is the beginning. And the thing about Little Richard, if you don't know him, or if you don't know his persona, he was always this flamboyant, completely larger than life character. And the one thing that he would tell you, the reason it's called I Am Everything is because he believed, and he would tell you that he did everything. He was everything. He created everything. And you know what? He was right. And this film shows you that. It's beautifully eye-opening. And like I said, it's a perfect time for this corrective measure. So it goes through the whole thing of talking about his life, where he came from. And it's really interesting because he was also like an early queer pioneer. But at that time, it was sort of like, there was a time when it was sort of okay. There was a time when in music, performers could go out in drag, and it was just part of the act, even though dressing like a woman was illegal. This documentary will explain to you that, you know, performers got away with it. So it's not like Little Richard was a cross-dresser. I'm just saying that, you know, if he was flamboyant a little bit here and there, it wasn't a problem during most of the time. But this goes like in depth into all the ways all the things that he himself soaked up, all the influences he soaked up. So we get to, like, in terms of credit where credit is due. So in terms of like a music documentary, it's fun. It's like, it's not the most out there kind of form, like formally stylistically out there documentary. It's pretty conventional, but I think you need that when you are talking about someone like Little Richard. First of all, there's so much you have to put into it about, like I said, like it's talking about where he came from and all the influences he absorbed, is trying to explain his position in music history, you know, his place, when he was performing, what was happening at the time. And then it goes on to his influences, right? So that's a lot to do right there. But then in terms of the personality, I think it's best that this filmmaker wisely just stepped back and just gave him the space to be who he was finally, and for us to like appreciate that. And it's for all, there are some difficult things that happened to him. Of course, there are some difficult things that happened in history. But in the end, you get this sense of like this strong being, you know, this strong man who just, this strong personality. And like I said, it just felt good to just sit back and go, yeah, and just have some fun with his music. Because, you know, some of his music, I think, you know, has fallen by the wayside and whatever. And I was tired of it. But I was listening to it, like, you know, on the soundtrack of the film as you're watching it. And it's like, wait a second, that does sound fantastic. You know, this is if you're watching this on your TV, if it comes out on CNN or if you go to the cinema, I hope it's loud, you know, loud and proud, just like Little Richard. That's all I got.
Oh, that sounds good. That sounds good. And I think that's a perfect place to end. We've seen some more films that we could even, you know, we'll talk about in the next episode, because there's just, yes, there's just too much. Sundance is just a wealth of stuff to see. So in the next episode, we'll continue with some of the ones that we didn't get to touch on in this episode.
Absolutely. Yes, those are just some of our favorites. So absolute favorites. Like, we have to heavily like edit these episodes down. Otherwise, we'd be talking for hours. So anyway, that's all the time we've got this time. For Courtney Small, I'm Barbara Kosofsky. This has been Frameline. Thanks for listening.